Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, Lorraine, I was watching our favourite TV programme, Yellow Jackets.
Yeah.
Little episode yesterday. Had a bit of a traumatic moment when fabulous Juliette Lewis was wearing knickers over a pair of fishnet tights.
Oh,
and it got me thinking about the whole knickers over or knickers under tights, because I have seen people in the gym put their tights on and then put their knickers on top. And I've always been very confused and slightly disturbed by it. What's going on?
They're not Batman, are they? He wears his stuff over his tights.
Yes.
I think it's very unhygienic unless you put your pants close to your vulva. Don't you?
I was slightly confused about why anybody would do
it. Have you road tested it?
I haven't road tested it. I don't want to road test that one, thank you. But I did have a quick look online just to see if I can find any in-depth forums.
Did you have a lot of free time yesterday?
Well, 5 minutes, yeah. 5 minutes after watching Yellow Jackets.
What did you Google?
It's very good.
Over tights.
Why do people wear pants over tights? And anyway, what I found was it's to stop the tights falling down. But I don't think Juliette Lewis in Yellow Jackets was doing it to have the tights falling down. I think it was because she looked really sexy and it was a sexy looking combo. But I just don't think in everyday life, pants over a pair of ten derniers.
What's happening inside your head, Trish, when you're seeing these things?
I don't know. I should be worrying about the bigger plot about cannibalism and all sorts of things.
That's the theme of the show to worry about.
Tights and pants, all in the detail.
Hello, welcome to Postcards from Midlife. I'm Lorraine Candy.
I'm Trish Halpin, and we're on a mission to help you make the most of your magnificent midlife. We'll be tackling everything from mind and body wellness to HRT and your sex drive. Lorraine and I are here to help you have a stylish second act and answer all your midlife questions on fashion, beauty, careers, relationships, family, and as always, the challenges and joys of parenting teens.
Stop the press, hold the front page. Trish has broken the internet once again. How has she done this, you may ask, at the beginning of this new episode? Well, she's done it with carrots, of course. Mm-hmm. We have been bombarded by requests for her carrot porridge recipe. So I have had a mad week of fending off the breakfast bandits, as I'm calling them on my social media. They are desperate to know the ingredients. Now, we all know how I feel about carrots, don't we, Trish? How do I feel about carrots?
Yeah, well, you don't like them, do you? No. Vegetables in general, big no from you. But I do know better than to talk to you about recipes, so I can see how you being asked by your millions of internet followers or Instagram followers might upset you, especially involving the devil's vegetables, as you call them, might tip you over the edge.
Well, it has tipped me over the edge because I don't mind you going a bit Nigella on me and talking to me about recipes, or actual Nigella going Nigella on me, as she once did. She gave me a hug once.
Name drop.
Anyway, but I do mind everyone else asking me for carrot tips. So I have started the RVRL. We're on manoeuvres, Trish.
Oh, God. Well, RVRL, what's that old nonsense?
That is the Root Vegetable Resistance League, my culinary friend. There are no carrots in porridge on my watch, and my people will make sure of that. Margot is with us, just FYI.
Oh, right. Yes, Margot, she doesn't really like root
vegetables. So, for the love of God, dear listeners, stop asking me, can you, Trish, once again, tell them where you got this breakfast.
It's having a lot of love on the Facebook group where I posted the recipe. So if you're a member
of
the Facebook group.
Not everyone can work Facebook, as we found out.
No, this is true. And otherwise, just search it up. Search it up on Riverford Organic, because I got it on a little leaflet with my veggie box when they delivered some extra carrots and said, here's what to do with your extra carrots. And it's changing the world. One carrot at a time, I think, isn't it? So now that's done, you've calmed down a bit. Yep. I think we should start the show, which today is a really special one because it's devoted to something we know our listeners are fond of, and that is our love of books. And rather spookily, we didn't manage this when we were doing it, but it's actually World Book Day, isn't it? While we're recording as well, in a spooky coincidence, all tying together.
As if we were professional podcasters. I don't know. Anyway, welcome to Postcards from Midlife, the book club edition. We have got today an exclusive discussion on the Women's Prize for Fiction long list, which was announced last week. I have got insider knowledge on this because I'm one of the five judges, and what a brilliant list it is.
Yes, so we'll be looking into the trends in fiction that have made it onto the list and helping our lovely listeners curate books which will expand their reading this year, or maybe get your reading mojo back, because if you lost it like I did last year, but it's back on with a vengeance. We've also got the author Tanya Shadrick coming on to discuss her brilliant memoir, The Cure for Sleep, A Late Waking Life, which is gathering really rather rave reviews.
Yes, it is. One critic wrote this about her brilliant book. It is such a bold, brave, beautiful story about birth, death, rebirth and building a larger life, which is something we all want to do, isn't it? So I'm looking forward to discussing all that with Tanya and also talking to her about her own midlife journey, which is part of starting a larger life, isn't it? Should we get on with it, my little bibliophile?
Yes, I think we should before I start Googling more porridge recipes to share with everybody, with our listeners. Maybe there might be a beetroot one, because that could send you completely mad.
God forbid. Last year, we had the author Kate Moss, OBE, on the show, and she told us that she had helped set up the Women's Prize for Fiction 27 years ago, because in 1991, the Booker Prize list had no women on it, which apparently had gone unnoticed by the judges. Now, this was during a time when the ratio of books published was 60-40 in favour of women. Mm-hmm. So it's quite shocking to think that that could happen in the 90s, which was modern times. And that's why this prize was set up, to promote female writers as a result. So the idea of the prize is to shine a light on the outstanding and ambitious fiction by women of diverse backgrounds from all over the world. And I have to say, the long list and the authors on it do just that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great book list. I always look forward to it every single year. I have to say, the Women's Prize is one I always look out for. And how fabulous that you are one of the five judges, because you are an author now, aren't you? Because you have your lovely book, which I think's just come out in paperback.
It has.
Yay. But there's a lot of books, I believe, 175.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, 175. How does that work? I'm doing the maths, can't work out how you're going to get through 175 books.
Well, it is a complicated process, and we read around 70 each, and then on the long list we all read each of the books, and then it goes down to a short list, and then it goes down to, obviously, the winner. So it's pretty thorough. But this year, the Women's Prize is also starting a campaign to highlight the need for men to read books written by women.
Yeah.
I hadn't really thought about this, but the campaign's called The Authority Gap, and it seems that from all the research, men just don't take women writers as seriously as they take male writers, which is something I just hadn't thought, but it obviously affects business and sales.
It's maddening, isn't it? So we know that for the top 10 best-selling female fiction authors, only 19% of their readers are men, and 81% are therefore women. But the top 10 best-selling male authors, the split is much more even. So 55% men and 45% women. So in other words, women are prepared to read novels by men, but men are a bit reluctant to read novels by women. I mean, how annoying. Let's try and change that with this list. So can we have a chat about it then? Can you tell us about some of the books?
I can. 16 books. Last year, the winner of the prize was Piranesi by Susanna Clarke, which was kind of a dystopian book about the future, which I'm saving to read because I've had so many other books to read. But I think one of the things I noticed on the list, there is a new genre called cli-fi, which is climate change fiction.
Oh, yes, right.
So there's a lot based around how the world is changing, envisaging how it could be in the future. The other thing I noticed is that women are so funny. These books are, even the more serious ones, are so funny, so smart. The humour is whip smart. It's really sharp. There's a lot of history. There's a lot of looking back. Trish, you will, I know you like that.
Historical, yeah.
There's a lot of lesbian relationships in the books, really well reflected. It's really... I've sort of waded my way through really intelligent, fierce, sharp writing. Now, I thought what I would do rather than read the list of the 16 albums, yes, we will put the list on the Facebook group for indeed everybody to see. So you've got it there, and it is a brilliant list, and you can start working your way through it. I think I will talk about the ones that I think our listeners would particularly mm-hmm like. Now, I haven't yet read, but it is on the list, Sorrow and Bliss by Meg Mason. But
I have read that book. I love that book.
It did make it because people have been gobsmacked by it, haven't they? It's kind mm-hmm of, and it's a debut novel as well, which yes is extraordinary. Yeah. Paper Palace, Miranda Cowley Heller, which was a number one bestseller on the New York Times, a kind of epic story of love, marriage, family and everything, mm-hmm, searing and immersive, the judges called that. I think that would be really good for our listeners. Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead. I don't think I've read a book quite so epic. It's about a female pilot during the Second World War. And ooh, it sounds as if it could be quite dry.
I quite like that. Really, I think you have not to get Neil to read that, okay? Because he doesn't yes read female authors, and he's obsessed with flying and Second World War. So that's one thing.
He'd absolutely love it because there's yeah a lot of technical detail in there yeah as well. And there is a book called The Bread the Devil Need, K-E-N-E-A-D, by Lisa Allen Agostini, which was is an independent publisher. It's a very small book. It's written in Creole.
Okay.
So it felt as if it might be quite difficult to read at the start. And it's a story of domestic abuse. So okay all those things would point to it being a difficult book. It was one of the most uplifting, smart, funny books mm-hmm I've ever read. So I think yeah really, I mean, again, these the thing I've learned from judging the list and reading these books, and I've obviously got a lot more left to read, is that you pick up books in a bookshop based on what you've always picked
yeah
up in a bookshop.
Yeah, it's your and reading actually, bubble, yes, isn't it? Your reading yeah bubble. Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have picked that book up mm-hmm in a bookshop. And it was so, so brilliant. And I think it would have been I would have missed out having
yeah
not read
yeah
it.
Yeah.
Now, Louise Erdrich's book, The Sentence, is on the list as well, on the long list. I mean, I'd sort of heard of her, but I don't know why I hadn't read her before. Mm. She won the Pulitzer. But this book, I mean, it was enormous. And my heart slightly sank because I'd read two books very swiftly. And I thought, oh, no, I've got this one to do. It's going to be, I'll put it off.
Yes.
I honestly, I couldn't put it down. I was carrying it around with me yeah to the shops to read in queues. Yeah. I was addicted to it. This book, mm-hmm, The Sentence, is about a Native American woman who rebuilds her life after prison, but it's also a ghost story. Ooh, so again, okay, I have absolutely low threshold on a ghost story because I don't believe in ghosts. I would say it was magical. And there is another book that was magical, which I would really urge everybody to read. But again, I don't think you or I would ever pick this book up mm-hmm in a bookshop. It's called Creatures of Passage by Morawa Yejide, Y-E-J-I-D-E. And it's about a woman who is a twin and her brother is murdered. And she drives a taxi that comes to life with a ghost, bear with me, with a ghost
ghosts,
in it. And it's set in Washington in a kind of weird dystopian future.
Yeah.
And I read the first page and I thought, oh, this is really going to challenge me. And then again, it was just, I read it till about 3 o'clock in the morning one night. I was so obsessed with the writing because it was so beautiful. And I think that's the brilliant thing about this list. It's so, the breadth of writing is really, really different. And there's so many different things in there. I mean, I don't know how we're going to come to a conclusion. I think it's going to take us absolutely days.
So when are we going to find out the winner?
There is a shortlist from the 16 mm-hmm down to 6 on April the 27th. And then in June, we announce the winner. June, but it gives you time to, so you, when we put this list on the Facebook, you could go off and start buying some of these. I think The Island of Missing Trees by Ellis Shafak, which was in the Reese Witherspoon book club. That's a book I think you would like.
I like her a lot, Turkish writer. Yeah. She's really brilliant, isn't she?
Yeah,
really good.
I mean, it's been such a magical time. I don't quite know what I'm going to do when I don't have to get up early to read books. Yeah. Or people don't send me to the shops and I say, oh yeah, I'll just nip out, and then I go and sit on the bench around the corner for 10
to read 10 pages.
Once you plan reading a book into your day, like you plan doing a bit of exercise or something, and it really broadens your mind and makes you think about things in a different way.
I found that when my mojo came back, I was like, instead of just kind of lying down at the end of a working day, I would pick up a book for, 10 minutes before I made dinner or whatever. And
it's quite meditative.
Kind of really get into it. Yeah, it's really good, isn't it? Shall I just tell you a couple of books?
Go on.
I've got three very different ones. I've got one by a man I know we're talking about women, but I've got one by a man, one that's an educational memoir, and one that's written by a contemporary of ours from the magazine world. So the first one is, the contemporary is Katie Regan, and she's written a book called How to Find Your Way Home. And she used to be a sort of features editor, commissioning editor at Company, Cosmo, and Marie Claire, of course, all our old stomping grounds. I was wondering whether readers might remember, if you bought Marie Claire, she wrote a really popular column called And Then There Were Three, and it was about her choosing to have a baby with a male friend. They were co-parenting essentially as friends, this child, and this column charted their often hilarious and quite complicated sometimes co-parenting journey. And that then led to her first novel, and this is her fourth novel, and it's also about a brother and a sister. You mentioned one about a brother and a sister who are kind of very close growing up and then are forced apart, and it's about how they find their way back to each other and rebuild their relationship. So I always like to kind of read and support women that we know who good books, and that's really good. Who do you want next, man or educational memoir?
What's the educational memoir?
This might not appeal to you, but it appealed to me because of me. Well,
I'll read anything.
Background.
Anything.
Well, actually, it will, because you're very international with your women's fiction prizes. Right. So this one has been described as an education for the mind and the heart. And it's a collection of personal essays by a medieval historian. It's Fierce Appetites by Elizabeth Boyle. And she was born in Dublin, grew up in Suffolk, went to university in Scotland, and then she now lives and teaches kind of medieval Celtic history, of all things. But she's a Gen X midlifer, so tells these personal stories about her life growing up that are peppered through with what you and I would call nostalgia noodles. Lots of noodling in there. So you really relate to it, and then you relate to the themes because they're all really interesting. They're about, you know, families, grief, losing her father, race, identity, her brother being committed to a psychiatric hospital, getting pregnant after a one-night stand, failed motherhood. So there's everything that you're kind of interested in. And then she relates them back to stories from medieval history, which is really interesting, really different. So I'm enjoying that. And I obviously now feel very brainy because I have read some of this book.
You are very brainy.
And then my final one, Crossroads by Jonathan Franzen.
Yes, I've read that.
I mean, I really like him. He's you know, the great American novelist, isn't he, of our age. You know, he wrote The Corrections, all those brilliant books. But the reason I brought this one up was because it caused a bit of consternation in our book group, whereby some people really just hated it. And I absolutely loved it. And I just thought it was really interesting how you could just be friends, women, similar interests, everything. You just don't get on at all. And this is the first of a trilogy of books that he's writing. So I'm desperately excited that there's going to be another two. And it's about this kind of Midwestern family in the early 1970s. The father is a pastor in the First Reformed Church. His wife, Mariam, has become middle-aged and invisible, of course, but she's harboring this shocking secret about her past. And their three children each have their own kind of triumphs and traumas going on as well. It's about how they all intersect and the lies they tell. But it's got sex, abortion, nervous breakdowns, Vietnam War, religion, smoking pot, affairs.
Everything that you like on a Sunday afternoon.
Loved it. That would have been one I would have taken to the shop in the queue.
Yeah.
I couldn't put it down. I loved it.
Obviously, we had to let go of a lot of books to get down to this 16 shortlist. And I will be putting them up on the Facebook book because I'm so attached to some of those that I argued really strongly for.
I suppose your judging was like a bit of a book group.
It is a kind of book group. It's a really mixed group of women of all ages and backgrounds as well on the judging panels. So I think, Trish, we have created what I would call a mega book club. We'll keep it going. If you fancy starting any of these books, they'll all be listed on the website, on our Facebook group. And I think we should also start recommending that our men read them as well, and that they start buying books. I'm going to challenge my husband to buy at least one book written by a woman when he next goes out to get a book. And thank you very much for all of that.
Yes.
I think that's an amazing list, isn't
and
it?
Next up, we're going to be talking to someone who's actually written a book, a memoir, in fact. So that's very exciting.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We'll be right back.
This week's guest is the writer Tanya Shadrick, whose beautiful and searingly honest memoir, The Cure for Sleep, A Late Waking Life, was published at the beginning of the year to critical acclaim. Charting her journey from a difficult childhood in which she endured a complex and often fraught relationship with her mother through to the near-death experience she encountered when she herself became a mother, Tanya details the profound awakening that saw her questioning how she could achieve freedom and self-fulfillment as a woman at the same time as being a mother. A former university administrator and hospice scribe, Tanya, now 48, recounts how she finally managed to carve out the space and the time to embark on an artistic life. And she's here today to share her advice on making changes and to talk about embracing a life of simplicity and slow living in Lewes, the East Sussex town where she lives alongside her husband, Nye, and her teenage children. We'll also be asking her about motherhood, the power of art and creativity, and why, no matter how late in life, she believes it's always possible to wake up and step out of the confines we have made for ourselves. Welcome to Postcards from Midlife, Tanya.
Hello, thank you so much for inviting me on.
It's been so fascinating and enjoyable reading your memoir, but I think we should start, because it's so powerful, we should start with the day that changed everything for you after the birth of your son, in which you nearly died and afterwards had this kind of realization that you felt you'd been sleepwalking through your life. Tell us what happened.
So I was 33 years old. I had just delivered my first child 10 days earlier, you know, normal emergency cesarean, and sent home within 2 days. The book kind of begins with my husband and I congratulating ourselves on our strange little, almost fairy tale life. We're very orderly, very disciplined, like people in a fairy tale, kind of congratulating ourselves on how quickly life has gone back to a new normal. The midwife has just left after pronouncing me, you know, what a neat mend you have. And then I reach for a book from the shelf and suddenly blood begins everywhere, all over the floor. So I knew instantly I didn't have very long to live, just enough to reach the telephone and call for an ambulance. And I learned later I probably would have died in less than 7 minutes because it was an arterial hemorrhage. So it's incredibly rare. About 1% of women will suffer a postpartum hemorrhage, but 1% of those would have something happen like I did when you're apparently well. And it was very sudden. It was also painless. And I think that's why it was so life-changing, because I had, as I say in the book, time and mind to really think about what was happening.
You say you knew you were dying. What does that feel like?
I describe it as being like a little boat traveling through space and time. I could feel myself going away. I say at the beginning of the book that it's not really my concern or interest whether that's the realm of religion or physics, or they think now it's just biochemistry, it's just something that happens to the brain. Doesn't really matter to me. It felt as real as anything that's ever happened to me in my life. It was like, one of the most interesting and strange things that's ever happened to me. And I had this painful confrontation with regret, you know, real visceral regret of, oh my God, I always wanted to be a writer. I hid from that. I've hid from everything because of my difficult childhood. I lived this tiny routine bound life, scuttling between home and the office, no friends except my husband and work colleagues. I had to change my life after. It wasn't just the regret, it was the joy of it. I mean, what a strange thing to say. After the regret, it was this sense of a great collective energy that wanted me to come out and play. And that's what made coming back from the emergency so difficult, because this routine-bound life I'd led, I suddenly had a glimpse of this beautiful energy precisely when I'd become the mother of a small child. So I was, you know, I was in a pretty deep hole at that coming back to life was quite hard.
But at that point as well, so being a new mum is a very peculiar place to be anyway for all of us, actually, because it's such a shock. But it does bring you face to face with your own mothering and the mothering you've had, because you had quite a traumatic childhood, didn't you? And your mother wasn't a traditional mother, and she had many difficult moments. Tell us what was going through your mind and what you kind of expected mothering to be.
Well, you see, this was what made it all the more extraordinary. As the book makes clear, I never wanted to be a mother.
Yes.
It wasn't the most abusive of childhoods by a long way, and that's sad that that's true. But it was a very frightening and a very loss-defined childhood, chaotic. My father left, started a new family in the small town I lived in, but had nothing to do with me. So that's an odd thing. My mum developed, you know, increasingly compulsive rituals around cleanliness. It was all very strange. I think the phrase I have in the book is I'd never wanted power over another person because I knew what it was like to have no power or to have people constraining me and shouting at me and frightening me. So I never wanted to be a mother. But at 19, I met this beautiful boy who promised to look after me my whole life. And we were 10 years in and he'd kept that promise. And all he'd ever wanted to be was a father since the age of five. It's just he didn't tell me that for our first 10 years together.
And you must have felt very safe at that point. You must have had safety for 10 years.
He was all I wanted. We literally had no friends but each other for 10 years. And those 10 years for me passed really quickly. They were really happy. And I did not see it coming the New Year's Day of our 30th year when he had tears in his eyes and said, please, when are we going to start a family? The book is full of threshold moments when you could walk away or give up on someone, but I chose to become a mother. So it's kind of extraordinary then that I had to have IVF and then also that I had this extraordinary thing happen to me after becoming a new mother. I didn't want to be a mother, and then being a new mother was, I think, more than normally hard. And as we all know, it's really hard anyway.
How do you feel as a mother now?
I love being a mother of these two particular people. I have many wonderful women who are mothers, who are my friends that I've met since becoming a mother myself. I still don't share a lot of the feelings they describe, you know, that physical delight in one's children. I touch them and hug them all the time. They're told every day they're loved. We're not a cold family. My kind of hunger for body and skin has always been for men.
Yeah, for desire.
Adults. My desire has always been for adults and equality. I love equality in relationships. Mm-hmm. I'm quite a careful mother, I would say.
It's interesting you say about men, because obviously the men in the book are very significant, because we start with the heartbreak of your father abandoning you and your mother and leaving you. And, you know, you say this one thing, if I'd been easier, prettier, and had more winning ways. It's just so heartbreaking to think that a child can feel that. And probably a lot of children do when parents leave. You blamed yourself, but you also contemplated leaving your own children, didn't you? Because of how you found yourself conflicted about the life and self-fulfillment that you wanted, and then finding yourself as a mother and these years stretching out ahead of you of mothering and the physical, emotional work that goes into that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I came around from the induced coma and realized I was back in this life that I'd so briefly almost escaped during the near death, my only wish running through my mind was, how do I get away and when? And there's a couple chapters in the book where you see me like really like a trapped animal kind of going, should I do it now when I can leave the hospital bed? Can I give it a year even to help my husband through the sleepless nights? For myself, I did just want to leave. I felt no love for my son because of all the emergency that had happened. It's not even selfish. I think because of everything I just endured physically, I think it was quite natural to want to go off somewhere and heal and be, you know, whereas the minute I came out of the coma, I was handed the baby to breastfeed because of hospital's obsession with breastfeeding these days. For reasons I describe in the book, I decided to stay. And to be clear, I think there are times when women and men need to leave. It's better for everyone. So there's nothing morally wrong with leaving. There are good ways to leave and bad ways to leave. My father left in a bad and irresponsible way. And the reason I stayed was because I knew how much my life had been warped out of shape by my father's absence. And there's a lovely line in a Sylvia Plath poem where she says to her newly fatherless child, you know, you'll be aware of an absence presently, sky like a pig's backside, an utter lack of attention. And that's what I suffered from in childhood, absolute invisibility. And I just couldn't do that to somebody else.
I suppose your awakenings, desire you had not to sleepwalk through life, having been through such a traumatic experience. One of the reasons it attracted Trish and I to talking to you on the show is it felt kind of describing how midlife feels for a lot of women, that you suddenly look back and think, hold on a minute, I've been sleepwalking through this last 10 years. I've just done what society expects of me, and I've stayed in the family, and I've done this whole... So one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is to talk about that feeling, because you're very proactive. You are make the change, recognize your own needs. How would you advise women to start looking at having an awakening like that as they hit this period of life?
I use the word stepping into a lot in the book. The book is full of thresholds. like doorways. You actually walk through a doorway of a swimming pool into a new community group. It can all be done in our heads. At some point, right, we need to physically step into different ways of being and connecting out of what I call the private. You know, there's a repeating idea in the book of I wanted to reach beyond the narrow roles of wife and mother in a small town. Mm-hmm. They were things I loved. They were things I was committed to, but they were too private. They were too atomized. And so it was all about finding ways to expand my identity and connect outwards. So beginning in my street, and that can be online. It can start in really small ways. You know, going to my local outdoor swimming pool changes my life in ways I mm-hmm. could never foresee.
And do you feel selfish doing that? A lot of women at this stage feel weighed down by what others expect of them, or the guilt of letting others down.
At the risk of sounding like a sociopath, and I'm not, because I have high empathy, I am not troubled by ideas of selfishness. I do not feel imposter syndrome ever. I really do understand how many women in particular mm-hmm. and how that is for them. I don't have it.
Mm-hmm. I don't.
And no. And
I'm not worried about what other people think either, which is quite a liberating, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah. I mean, I was always worried about what people think. It was in my background, that working class rural culture, everybody knows everybody's business. Everybody offers their opinions very loudly. If you are important, we're all important. Yeah. Sometimes mm-hmm. my children take precedence, and sometimes my husband, sometimes a friend who's in need. But then also that means surely I must sometimes come first. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, yeah. that there's no balance. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense if everyone else's needs are more important than yeah. ours.
Some people, you talk about, you know, judging you for when you gave up your job and embarked on this kind of artistic project that you didn't know what was going to come of it. And other women didn't like that, did they? You were kind of judged.
Oh, sure. And it comes from people you kind of consider not your close friends, but people in your day-to-day circle, women the same age and stage as you. And I didn't see that coming. You know, but you know, I changed my life in quite an unusual way in the end for a shy and hidden person by doing some performance art in my local town, writing on a huge scale. And you know, are we scribbling? And aren't you lucky that your husband will let you do this? And it's really fascinating what is drawn out to people when somebody, particularly in a small town, I think the smaller your community, the less you have to do to attract curiosity, attention, mockery, comment, also support. You know, I got a lot of support, but not from close friends. It came from strangers.
Do you want to tell us about the project? Because it's so fascinating, the swimming pool project. It's quite remarkable.
It's funny that I've got so many people I'm connected to now because of what I did by the pool, but I only really swam outdoors in cold water at the Lido for a couple of summers, and I haven't since. So I'm not a proper swimmer like you, Lorraine. It kind of came out of constraints and limits, and I now teach people that most creativity and big life change actually comes out of looking at your limits and finding a way to do something within them. So I only had school hours, which isn't very much, as we all know. No. The year before, I'd started swimming in the outdoor pool as part of this expansion of the body and just letting myself do new things. And I'd always written private diaries. I'd always wanted to be a writer, never sent anything off, even to a competition. And I suddenly thought, well, I know I can write my diary. So what if I just change the scale? What if I make them like a performance, like a spectacle? And I got permission from the pool because they knew me. And I decided a mile of writing, it's a bit like a mile, an open mile of swimming. You know, my head was kind of, it's the first time I was being really creative. And I decided I would do a mile of writing beside the pool. I sort of knelt down at a little table like a Japanese scribe. The paper would be as long as a swimming pool. So it was originally, I called it Laps of Longhand. Mm-hmm. So I had this idea that I would write lines. So 50 meter long roll of paper, 7 lines on each of the 5 rolls, so the 5 swimming lanes. Yeah. And I've got tiny, neat handwriting. So it was novel length, it was 100,000 words. It took me 2 springs and summers. They're kind of demented. They're so neat. There's hardly a crossing out on them. And I was just composing them in real time, sometimes surrounded by hundreds of children in wet swimming costumes, shrieking and running around me. I've never done anything before or since that was as soulful, exciting, It was just delicious. I didn't think of myself as a creative person for all I'd wanted to write. And suddenly I had an idea. And then even more importantly, I made it material. I actually said I'd do something and I did it. Mm-hmm. And that's a really powerful feeling.
Hugely practical thing to do as well, isn't it? It's a very specific physical thing to sit down and do all that. And it's kind of your approach to life now is what they call slow living, you know, slowing down. How would you describe that? That's something I feel a lot of us after big manic careers are looking for.
For me, it's kind of how I grew up, because I grew up in a really remote rural kind of region, mainly raised by my grandparents or part raised by my grandparents, and my husband the same. So we've always been a bit out of time. We've always been, you know, more like people from a different generation. It's lovely now to see more people learning how to grow things and how to tend things and make things by hand. But, you know, I always have. So there's a crochet blanket just across from me that I began making when I couldn't get pregnant first. You know, my husband's out in the garden today growing, and we've got hundreds of little seed trays all over the house. I sometimes resist the phrase slow living because, of course, it has a kind of a commercial lifestyle magazine
weird wellness thing around it. Yeah.
And it's just not that for us. It's just who we've always been. I think those many people of my generation didn't get raised by elders. You know, maybe they traveled with their parents' jobs. Most of my friends did move around a lot in their childhood. They didn't have any grandparents around. Mm-hmm. And part of when I made all my mother friends, part of what I brought to the group was the ability to make things and a certain way of passing time that I shared with them.
Back to midlife, really, and this is obviously something we ask everybody on the show, the physical changes as well. Did you have any sense about perimenopause, about changes that happened to women from the women that you grew up with and around?
Only from my mother. She had me relatively late in life, and during my teenage years, she had multiple problems that she was dealing with, mental health issues and a very dark second marriage. Just the menopause was brutal. Just up all night pacing the house because of restless legs. You know, it's something really frightened me. There's a part in the book where I describe how in my early 40s I come off the pill for a whole range of reasons, but also to know what my body was doing. So for me, before I hit the perimenopause, where my desire has changed and it's made me really sad, I had this massive uprush of desire, which I could not, no amount of marital sex could assuage it. It was like existential levels of physical desire when I came off the pill in my early 40s. Now I'm coming closer to 50 and I'm 6 months into HRT, and my gosh, I needed it. Because I was off the pill, I really did notice this physical change in me. It was appalling. Physical desire has always been such an important part of my life, despite being in this, you know, it's a long marriage that doesn't change that. And I really miss it. It's still not quite as it was.
It was very much part of who you were, wasn't it? The physical desire. I mean, you've written about it. I know a lot of women, this bit of life between sort of 40 and 55, and particularly those in long-term marriages, lose desire, or their desire changes. Many women we've talked to start relationships with women, having been married a long time. How do you get in touch with your desire in midlife, in your libido? Where's the entry point, the doorway, the threshold for that?
Okay, for me, it happened in relation just to myself and the outside day, me and my body, because my husband and I have always been very compatible physically. So for me, it was a different thing. I had to spend more time on my own in public, taking up space, dressing in a certain way, letting the sunlight touch my skin. So I've always been quite modest in how I dress. So I spent a lot of time sunbathing on the side of the Lido in my town. Just, I fell in love with my painted red nails. And I say in the book that it's not narcissism for me, because to me, narcissism is that classic thing of you are interested in yourself to the exclusion of others.
Yeah.
For me, when I took pleasure in my skin and my body, I also had more attention for everybody else. I wasn't trapped in my own head feeling dull or hung up about my body shape. I was in love with myself and everyone else. So for me, desire was more about a love for life, not mm-hmm. just a narrow definition of sexual desire.
So another woman who had a big impact on your life, and also another swimming connect, and they were sort of independent, weren't they? They just, these two projects to do with swimming, yeah. was Lynn Roper, who's a former paramedic, whose diaries you edited and published after her death, and they were called Wild Woman Swimming. Tell us about that project, and also this becoming a hospice scribe. I mean, that was fascinating.
Well, that was the first thing I did. So when my daughter was still, I don't know, 2, 3, I only had like a couple hours a week to myself. I thought, what can I do to start changing my life? Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, I think I can probably be trusted because of my senior job at this university. And my local hospice let me work with people at the end of their life. Mm-hmm. It wasn't very many over the 4 years I did it, but it was kind of exciting. I would get called up. Mm-hmm. I would receive a message that somebody wanted me to meet them in the hospice or at their home. Sometimes I'd meet them several times, sometimes just once. And it was because they'd been seized with that kind of agitation and regret that I had experienced during near death. So that's the first way I changed my life. Mm-hmm. And then I'm this woman at the pool doing the writing, and I do my first little blog post. I've got like 10 followers on Twitter. I get a message from a woman who had grown up in, who was from Devon, where I grew up, mm-hmm. saying, you know, I've just read your blog post about being in the sea in Devon as a child. And that was like my childhood. But like, I've always wanted to be a writer, but I have left it too late. I'm dying now of cancer. And I've got my online swim diaries, but I've never edited them. And this is like a massive thing to ask. But because you've been a hospice scribe, because you come from Devon, mm-hmm. because you're by a swimming pool this summer, like, will you talk to me about living wild in the face of death? Will you look at my diaries and try and do something with them? Mm-hmm. And I think she only wanted me to include them in a little kind of anthology of writing about water that I was doing that summer.
Yes.
And I think that was my intention too. But I met her just once a month before she died in her hospice. And it was just one of those, again, a threshold moment. I literally walked into the door of her hospice room. She just had a brain operation. So she was swollen by the medicine. She had like staples down her head, and we just, yeah, it's like when you fall in love at first sight, or you find the person you're going to spend the next 30 years with. We only met once, but I came away from that meeting and I started to look at these diaries she'd written really quick. And I remember looking at my husband in the car and thinking, well, this is what life is. This is mm-hmm. what brings us to the best things in our life, when we let our life's direction be changed by chance,
yeah,
or by good people.
So you were talking to people, I like the word agitated, at the end of their time and trying to do honour to what they wanted, you know, to leave behind, some kind of written legacy. What did you learn?
I'm not medical. I'm not a counsellor. I didn't work with thousands of people. This isn't research-based. This is just, I'm an experienced person. I'm a sort of person who's interested in how to live and how to die. What I learned from those people was that something was disturbing their peace. Sometimes it was quite mild, like a little bit of their conscience was troubled, not by any great transgression, just, it's a shame that I'm still not feeling okay about that. What I learned was we just need to get better as a society at listening to difficult things that can't be fixed. Mm-hmm. And this is particularly hard when it's our parents, because I also learned that so many of the people I met had family in the next room. And a repeated phrase that I heard from a lot of my clients was, they're all out there wanting me to say something about them as children. We want our loved ones at the end of their lives to tell us about us, and they're often wanting to go to a quite different place in their memory. You know, it was extraordinary that people might be revisiting something before they'd had their families. That doesn't mean the families weren't loved. You know, what I was doing was so simple. I think the real power in what I did was simply I was prepared to go and meet strangers, listen to them, and not try and make them feel better and not to try and get anything for myself out of that. And I think that's something we can all offer more people in our communities. You know, when we have our elderly neighbours who want to just talk about their dead husband, let's get better at listening to that, because it really helps them.
Is there one thing that stood out for you, anyone that kind of pops up in your mind all the time?
Yes. And in the book, I describe it. And I did ask permission right at the very beginning. It was my first ever hospice client. And he was a lovely man. And he had a loving wife. And they were surrounded by all the kind of photos of their rich, long married life, working class man. He was very worried about, you know, the end of his life. But we were kind of just making a list of things he'd owned and bought. You know, it was, his wife was prompting him. I asked a really actually quite stupid question about what did you do with your pay packet once the bill was paid? And I thought, what an idiotic. Because it was my first hospice client, so I was a bit out of my depth. But it was just like hearing someone sing. He just began to talk about the first ever foreign holiday they'd ever been able to afford in the 60s. And they went to camp by an Italian lake, and a big storm came up, and all the men on the campsite were out in the dark together, all these men of different languages, hammering all the tents down and securing everything on the campsite. And he just talked. And he was like lyrical, you know, and everybody has some poetry in them. That was my other big learning. And that was joyous.
And it must have been interesting to see their relationships, such a long relationship right to the end. And of course, talking of long relationships, you've been with your husband since you were 19. So the idea of sustaining a long-term relationship when you're so young, when you get together and you're both going to grow and evolve and change. I mean, I met my husband when I was 19 as well, but it's about sustaining that relationship. And, you know, it hasn't been without its ups and downs, has it? Because you did become romantically involved with somebody else. And that was a very big part of the story, isn't it? And that was something you had to talk to your husband about and work out and resolve for yourself.
How old was I? I think I was 42. And a work meeting had brought me to the door of a stranger. I knew nothing about them. They had no online life. And I'd gone to them for a very particular piece of help with a performance project I hoped to do after my mile of writing. Another threshold, the door opened, the person was on the phone. I remember stepping across the doorway and feeling like life had just like tilted. Nothing more than that. But then within a couple of months, I knew I'd fallen in love. And then within another couple of months, I realized this person loved me too. But I was about to go away on a once in a lifetime residency for a month in a foreign country, which the mile of writing had earned me. So my life was changing really fast. I'd gone from being a really obscure wife and mother to someone who was being interviewed. I had, you know, a centerfold thing in a magazine. That sounds a bit more racy than it was, you know, trendy kind of like 30, 20 something magazine had done a 5-page photo feature on me. I was on regional TV, national radio, and suddenly I'm going off to Switzerland and I've fallen in love. And our marriage was under strain because we weren't coping with me changing. My husband's very generous. He wanted me to change. He was supporting me materially to do that. But emotionally, he was entering a sleepwalking phase of going, well, I'm a breadwinner and I'm holding up this family and there is nothing for me beyond work and home till retirement. So he was hibernating precisely at the point when my engines were running so rich. You know, hormones, ambition, appetite. And then I find this other person who feels as necessary to me as my husband had when I met him. No, I'm not going to say I should have turned away from it because, you know, I'm not a promiscuous person. I've only loved two men my whole life. I just had the misfortune to find two people I wanted to share my whole life with. And that was an incredibly difficult time in my life. And I paid for it in lost friendships, social ostracism. My marriage actually survived it and went on to grow and strengthen afterwards. But I don't have that other love in my life. That's a source of sadness. You know, there is a person I would still like to be sharing my life with. But yeah, I had this idea that, like Leonard Woolf, who Virginia Woolf's husband, who lived nearby, and he shared his life after Virginia's death with a married woman quite happily and peacefully till the end of his life. So I had this idea that I could have a shared life, not a menage a trois, that I'd be able to divide my time between the two men. And incredibly, my husband was prepared to consider that because of who I was and the books we've grown up reading. You know, we've read Virginia Woolf and Ys Nin, we've read Iris Murdoch, both of us. And the other love wanted that too. It was beyond us. If there's a way of doing it, there's not enough being written about it. We couldn't find enough guidebooks. Not with my husband. My husband wasn't jealous at all. He was worried for me and my well-being, rightly, because I did suffer terribly from attempting this. Not jealousy. It was the social criticism. It was a very private arrangement, but quite quickly I had a devastating letter put through my
door.
Yeah. And an older woman who had been one of my closest friends who'd helped me raise children dropped the letter through the door, like ending our friendship forever, calling me sordid. And she didn't ask for details, but she had heard that I cared for someone else because I didn't get caught in an affair. I told my husband I'm in a real situation because I love you and I love someone else and I don't know what to do, and I think I'm probably going to end up with nothing or without either of you, but I have to admit this need.
Yeah.
And then the other love soon after received a letter from someone likewise close to him that was, I think, also devastating, and we just couldn't we were just too new and we just couldn't recover from it. So it was really sad. And in the book, I don't minimize that or dodge that. It's not this the book is not some triumphant story of a woman seamlessly and easily rising up from the moment she has her awakening. That's why I feel able to write the book, because I make some big mistakes. I'm also proud that I tried to do this unusual thing. I tried
to step outside of it.
I tried to remake my domestic arrangements, just like I'd remade myself to be a mother, just like I'd remade myself to be part of a community of women who are mothering. You know, I've tried at each stage since the near death to remake arrangements for living and loving, and in some respects I've really succeeded beyond my wildest dreams. But in that instance, trying to remake the way men and women live together, I didn't get what I wanted. So I failed.
Well, it didn't. There's lots of ends, isn't there? You've left an end not tied up. That's it failed then. Yeah.
And how is the relationship with your husband? How it must have changed and evolved since that time as well.
I think the reason we're still together now, as I say, he was able to contemplate this difficulty and sadness I brought to him because of the type of people we are intellectually, because of the books we've read, the things we believe in. The reason we endured for these 5 years since the attempt at this shared life, as I call it, is because we made a decision when he flew out to me on the residency. I said, I'll answer anything. Ask me and I'll answer. But he chose not to ask.
Okay.
He said, I'm not going to ask what's happened over the last 6 months. I'm not going to go into where and when and what, because you'll either tell the truth or you'll lie. And just the amount of talk will feel cathartic, but it won't be. It'll be details we can't recover from. And I think that was a really wise decision. I think that's why we're still together.
The publicness of it now, though, you obviously had to discuss putting all of this into the book and being here talking about it as well. So it sounds like your communication is really strong as a couple.
We've got this phrase, the romance of maintenance. It's borrowed from an American writer about buildings, and we've had that in our life since we were in our 20s, this concept of the romance of maintenance, which is real romance, real love. It's about what you tend, and it's about how things change shape over time rather than trying to maintain this perfect romantic idea of a fixed thing. We see ourselves as kind of like a big old garden or a crumbling mansion that's kind of, you're shoring it up, and you know, it's the opposite of a perfection approach to life. It's like, how do you improvise fixes? My husband's also got this lovely concept of ebb and flow. Like, we don't do Valentine's Day, we don't always even buy Christmas or birthday presents. We buy them for the children, make a big deal for the children, but for ourselves we rarely do it because we've been together 30 years. But every now and then we see something perfect for each other and we just get it.
So you talked about how important books are in your life and history of literature and how they've influenced you. We did ask you before you came on to give us, I think, two or three books that you think would be good for our listeners to dip into. Which ones have informed you most, do you think?
These are going to sound highbrow, but I don't apologise for that, because actually they're not. They are literary, but they're such great guides to living. So in my 20s, when I was this shy little administrator, I lived through the diaries of Anise Nin, the 1920s.
Yeah.
You know, well, she was writing all through her life, but her diaries, they fill up a whole bookshelf in a library. She wrote compulsively from the age of 11 when her father left her. And she was a young married wife like I was, like you were, Trish, but then began an affair with Henry Miller in her late 20s and then went wild. Her diaries are shocking, but they're also generous. So she was deceitful, but she was also generous and supportive of others and just explored the further reaches of womanhood and desire. I mean, anything that's being written today is tame in comparison to her diaries. And so few people have read them. And I just think that I would say to
women. I think Lisa Tadeo is the only one who's come near it recently in mm-hmm. her.
Yeah.
In her novel, actually, more than her.
Yeah, Animal. Is really, you're right, it's the closest. And you've interviewed her, haven't you?
Yeah, we had her on the show, yeah. I mean, she writes about uncomfortable women as well and thinking uncomfortable things. Yeah.
Right, so we're all going to be reading the diaries of Anais Nin. Next up on your list.
The collected or all the poetry of Adrienne Rich, the American writer, because like Nin, but differently, she was being published from her early 20s right through to the end of her life. And it's interesting when you said earlier about women that you interview are moving into female relationships, same-sex relationships when they reach midlife. So she was the mother of three children by the end of her 20s. I think by her 40s, she was in female relationships for the rest of her life. And her poetry charts that change, and her writing about being a woman in her 40s. I mean, she's good throughout her life, but from the 1970s poems onwards, I'd say start with Adrienne Rich's poetry written in the 1970s and on into the 80s. They are just, my mile of writing was in part powered by just a couple lines in Adrienne Rich, where she talks about freedom being routine, prose bound, remembering. Like, you know, inch by inch, you know, like changing your life inch by inch. And she talks about, you know, being a woman at 49 and the light being critical of her. And, oh, it's so physical. But she's engaging with politics and sex. And she's not as known in England as I feel she should be. So big fan of Adrienne Rich. And of course, Cheryl Strayed is in Wild, both in the film and obviously the memoir the film is based on. That's one of the key books she carries with her when she's grieving for her mother, because her mother and she were both studying at college. You know, she takes a book, I think it's Dream of a Common Language. She takes it with her on her hike.
Now, so for any women who are sort of harboring this feeling of they haven't realized their full creative potential in midlife, how do you even start? I read about an exercise that you did to make a list. Do you want to explain that and how that helped you?
I do think of myself as a creative person. I have this confidence that I can make projects literally out of nothing, you know, out of some tins or matchboxes. But when I wanted to change my life, once the children were both in school, I didn't even have any likes. I didn't even have hobbies. I wasn't depressed, but it was just like an absence of anything personal to me that I felt strongly about, because it had all been crowded out by work and mothering, and we all know how this feels. I kind of came up with this idea. Ray Bradbury, the science fiction writer, talks about making lists. If you want to always have something to write about, lists from your childhood, lists of what you love, lists of what you hate, lists of what you feared, like the clown, the great aunt. And I thought, what if I make a list of 100 things I love? I remember it took me all one day. I was sitting on the back step, the children were in school, and I couldn't think of anything to say. So it was like, I like peeling an apple. I like the cats in the sun. I mean, it was painful to try and put words on paper. But just 2 years later, I'm writing a mile in public on giant rolls of paper. So I am proof that you can live your entire first 40 years without joining a club, a society, without going clubbing, without nothing. I was so hidden. And yet from that exercise on my back doorstep, like, what do I love? What did I ever love? And what was magical? And it's magical because I do it with people all the time now. What's magical and moving and exciting is that most people's lists start off pretty conventional. And then you get to about number 60 and you speed up a bit and you're like, I love the feel of my body in the arms of, I love. And then by the end, it gets into really big soul stuff. Like, I stand for this in the world. Yeah. And then you start getting personal desire mixed in with your morals and your ethics and your ambitions. And of course, that's the beginning of a creative life. That's the beginning of a life that's more meaningful for you and also has more use to others beyond home and family.
It's been so lovely speaking to you, Tanya. I think everything you said will really resonate with women of all ages, actually. So thank you.
The messages I'm getting from people are incredible. I mean, every day. And this is why I've risked these tender stories from my life about my marriage and why my husband has supported me in that, because I hoped beyond critical and commercial reception, I do measure the book by how many people it's bringing into my life. And women are writing to me saying, you know, I love my husband, but I haven't been coerced. Mm-hmm. I decided I was too much. I myself chose to let it all go. I'm getting them every day.
Oh, that's so good.
So that's what I stand for in the world.
There's a tingly feeling around your book. I think it's going to be quite a game changer.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Here we are. Nostalgia Noodle, Best Bit of the Show, Serious Journalism, here we come. So I've been talking books, writing books, thinking books. And this week, my eldest was back from university to go for a job interview, the various things part of her course. And she brought her sewing kit because she is very crafty. I don't know who these children are related to. And in her sewing kit was my bookmark from when I was very, very small. So I think probably, well, I am still very small physically. I would have been about 8 or 9 because it's my old sewing kit that I brought from home, which she uses, just trying to make it all make sense to the listener. And it's a very tiny one with a massive fluffy yellow head and googly eyes. Googly eye, as it
were. Because one's fallen off.
How can a thing last that long? I mean, it ties into the theme of books, but back in the day, we all used bookmarks, didn't we? Now I just fold over the
page. Oh, do you? No, I still use a bookmark. I've got one that's a laminated, made in the nursery school by the twins. And it's
does it not fall out and you drop it around the house?
No, I'm quite careful with it. I think I'm extra careful because I know it's made by the twins when they're about 3. And it's like little fingerprints in robins, made into robins and sort of splodges and things and laminated, but very sweet.
Offer you some advice on that now ahead of the leaving home situation. Oh, yeah. I feel like you should swap bookmarks because every time after they've gone in September, saying it out loud, Trish, they are going, you will open that book on that bookmark and you'll be in floods of tears for about half an hour. It'll impede your day. Yeah, I would suggest you go and get a Waterstones one.
Yes, I will. I think because you're right though, we did always have bookmarks. You'd buy them for somebody's little birthday present, wouldn't you? But not sure you would these
not
days.
A thing anymore.
Let's go on a mission and see if we can find some fun bookmarks because life's just
and
so
could,
exciting.
Could everybody, yes, because I know you've got nothing else to do, team listening, could everybody who's got their bookmarks from 1904 like mine pop picture of them on the Facebook group for me. I will get her to send me my
bookmark sharing. Well,
where have you been?
Well, you see, I wasn't as clever as you and tie in with our book special. I've done booze, alcohol doesn't go anywhere near what you're doing, but do you remember sweetie drinks? Perno and Black teenage drinks.
Please don't say that. It brings back an awful flashback behind a bus shelter.
Oh, there we are. Pink sick, probably. Pink vomit. Oh, my God. Yes. And Southern Comfort and Lemonade. Those were the
Southern
two.
Comfort and Lemonade.
Do you remember? Oh, my God. I don't know whether anybody drinks the Perno and Black anymore. Do you remember? It's that weird aniseed-y flavour.
I love aniseed, but because of an... It must have been very cheap in Cornwall in the late 80s.
Did you nick a lot
when
of it?
When you have too much, you can't really even smell it ever again, can you?
Oh, God. No, it's just... It is vile. I mean, the sort of stylish French drink it with a bit of water in it. But blackcurrant, why would you put that in a drink? Anyway, Southern Comfort. I moved from Perno and Black onto Southern Comfort, another sweetie drink. And I've got a fascinating fact. Janis Joplin used to drink Southern Comfort on stage when she was performing. She used to have a bottle in her hand. And that's like a weird sort of whiskey liqueur. All the sweetie drinks.
What would you have on say you were a rock goddess from the 70s like Stevie Nicks, what would you have on hand?
Maybe
on stage?
A cup of cocoa or a beetroot juice, maybe. What do you think?
One of those disgusting teas that you drink.
Yes, exactly. Something healthy. Boring. So that brings us to the end of this week's Postcards from Midlife. I think the bookmarks, we may have opened up a whole new porridge gate territory with
looking
bookmarks.
Looking forward to that. I can engage with bookmarks, not porridge.
Bookmarks from your childhood, bookmarks you use now, bookmarks your kids have made, that kind
special
of thing.
Special ones your friends have made for you. Hint, hint.
Yeah.
I haven't got one, have
one
I?
For your birthday.
Don't you one?
Oh, I'll stop you turning down the corners of all those books.
Yeah,
right.
I could see that made you angsty.
Yes, I didn't
itchy.
Like that. No, didn't like that. Anyway, new episodes of Postcards from Midlife are available to listen to every Sunday on your podcast provider. And it really helps us if you can download your episodes so they count on our listener numbers. And also, if you could pop a little review and rate us on your app as well, that would be really helpful.
And please tell all your friends about us. We want as many women as possible to join in our midlife conversation, which is what our private Facebook group is all about. That's where it's all happening, isn't it, Trish?
Yes.
So if you're not a member, do come over and join in our chat.
Yes, and you can use it to post any feedback on the topics we discuss, as well as suggestions for other things you'd like to hear talked about, or celebrities and experts you'd love to hear interviewed. And you can, of course, email us at hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com or pop a little message on the old Instagram. Goodbye.
Bye.